Humphrey, Jason said, unhappily. You essentially came in here to ask me if I'm an immoral person, which is more than a little rude. This is the answer I have for you. If you don't want to listen, the door works just as well for leaving as it did for coming in. Jason gestured at the door. Humphrey glanced at it, but turned his gaze back to Jason. All right, then, Jason said. Imagine you're on a contract. You have to go to a town out in the desert, way out past the delta. It'll take you a few days to get out there, and you've stopped overnight along the way. You're in a little town, staying at the only inn. You've had a long, hot day on the road, and you don't want to just eat a spirit coin and go to bed, so you head downstairs. The common room is busy, but you find a quiet corner to have something to eat and drink without anyone bothering you. What does this have to do with anything? I'm setting a scene, Jason said. So there you are, minding your own business. But like I said, the common room is busy. Some people are eating. Everyone's drinking. There's this one guy. You've been seeing him all night because he's loud and his aura is the strongest one here. Not compared to you, but a couple of essences make him the toughest guy in this little town. Jason paused to take a glass of juice from his inventory. Want one? He asked. No, Humphrey said, then smacked his dry mouth. Actually, yes, please. Jason handed over a second glass, taking a sip of his own. Just make sure and use a coaster, Jason said. Wooden tables don't grow on... Oh, I guess they kind of do. What? Doesn't matter, Jason said. So, this guy is the town tough. It becomes clear as the evening goes on that he and everyone else knows it. There's this girl, young, pretty, who works at the inn. The guy has been giving her a hard time, and it's only getting worse the more he drinks. Everyone can see what's happening. He's too rough. She's too young. But all she can do is bear it. No one is stepping up to help her, because he's the strongest guy in this town. Jason looked Humphrey straight in the eye. Except he isn't, Jason continued. Not this time. That night, you're there. So what do you do? The right thing is obvious, Humphrey said, but you're clearly setting me up to be wrong. Of course I'm setting you up to be wrong, Jason said, but that doesn't change the situation. The girl is clearly uncomfortable. As this guy goes deeper into his cups, he's even hurting her a little, but no one is saying anything. They might give him some covert looks, but they won't challenge him. What do you do, Humphrey? I stop him. How? I go over there and suppress his aura. He's not iron rank, Jason said. He's too weak to sense your aura and too drunk to realize what you're doing to his. This is his town, and he's the toughest guy in it. You've just challenged that, and he's way past making smart choices. He wants a fight. He shoves you. I kick him out on the street. That works, Jason said. You're stronger than him at his best, which he is far from in that particular moment. He wants to keep fighting, but he's got a couple of friends sober enough to realize you're an adventurer and not to be messed with. They take him home before he can cause any more trouble. Then what? Then nothing. Without that guy and his friends around, the mood is lightened and everyone has a pleasant evening. The girl thanks you nervously and you go to bed. The next day you move on because you still have a long road ahead. I don't see the problem, Humphrey said. Well, Jason said, what happens the next night? You're not there, but the town tough isn't going anywhere. His reputation just got destroyed. He was manhandled and humiliated in front of everyone. It was mostly by his own actions, his own arrogance and pride. But he doesn't care. Who does he take it out on? How does he re-establish his dominance? How does he put the fear back in these people? How does he teach them what happens if they confront him the way you did? What happens to that girl? You think I should have left things the way they were? I don't know, Jason said. Standing up for those who can't stand up for themselves is a virtue. But if acting on that virtue puts more hurt into the world than it takes away, is that still moral? Humphrey slumped in his chair. I don't have an answer to that. There isn't always a good option, Jason said. Doing nothing to change a bad situation may not feel right, but if anything you do will make it worse, then it's the only choice to make. What does that have to do with what you did in the Mirage Arena? Humphrey challenged. Do you know why your mother lets us spend time together, Humphrey? She doesn't decide who my friends are. Of course she does, Jason said. Answer the question. Why? Humphrey asked. You didn't answer mine. You always answer questions with more questions. Fine, Jason said. You want a simple answer. Then here it is. Things are complicated. That's it. Your mother wants you to recognize that the world is a lot more complicated than right and wrong, good and evil. I don't think the way you do, and she wants that to challenge you. You think she wants me to think like you? No, Humphrey, Jason said, shaking his head. It's like forging a sword. A sharp edge takes heat and hammering. She wants your principles to go through the fire so they don't collapse once you're out in the world where she can't watch over you. I've been playing along, but I want a friend, not a frigging ethics pupil. Jason sat up straight in his chair and continued, voice rising as pent-up frustration leaked out. I may not always make the best choices. Sometimes I do things that are selfish and hurt other people. I try and do good. And when I fall short, I try to do better. That's all I can do. All anyone can do. How was hanging Hannah's corpse up like a party decoration trying to do better? That wasn't real, Humphrey. But it could be. The consequences of what we do as adventurers, the risks we take. Yes, what I did was traumatizing, but now they have a better idea of what could be out there waiting for them, and they're a little more ready for it than they were before. You think I don't know what my powers are? And if they freeze up because they're afraid of what you did really happening? Then they shouldn't be out there at all, Jason said. Isn't that the whole point of all this training, to make sure we go out as ready as we can be? Does that justify what you did to them? My powers are what they are, Humphrey. There's no point trying to stab someone with a hammer. If I run around pretending I have your powers, then I will die, and die quickly. Maybe I should have waited for different essences, but you have no inkling of how lost I was when I first came here. I would have done anything for just a little bit of control over my circumstances. And now, all I can do is live with the consequences. You think that makes it all right to terrorize people? I know what my powers are, Humphrey. Misery and death. Blood turned black with taint, your body dying around you while you're still alive. You think I want to use that on a person? Maybe someone wants to come after me, but they hear about that day in the arena. Maybe even see the recording. They decide against coming after me because the price of failure is too high. Not some clean, quick kill, but a slow, lingering death. Every enemy that fears me too much to come after me is a person I don't have to use those powers on. Humphrey shook his head. You're good with words, Jason. Anything I say, you'll have an answer for. He stood up. That's why I'm done listening. I watched what you did in that arena. I listened to you taunt them. I've never heard a sound so cruel, so inhuman, as you laughing at the suffering of others. Humphrey, that was just theatrics. Was it? Humphrey asked. He walked over to the door and opened it. I think you need to take a look inside yourself, Jason, to find out where that was coming from. Chapter 75. Progress. So, Clive asked, the original sanguine horror came from the full creation process, the sacrifice chamber, the alchemy pit, the whole thing. As he talked, he enthusiastically gesticulated with a fork, a piece of fried sausage skewered onto the end. The whole thing, Farrah said. The large suite shared by Farrah, Gary, and Rufus included a space with a large dining table. The three of them, plus Jason and Clive, were eating the breakfast Jason had brought upstairs from the inn's kitchen. Gary was excavating the small hill of sausage, egg, and fried vegetables on his own huge plate, while Jason and Rufus ate quietly. Farrah and Clive were caught up talking, having barely picked at their food.
I'd love to see that chamber, Clive said.
I'm not going to stop you, Farrah said, but it's way out in the desert, so I'm not going to take you there either.
And the Awakening Stone came from the horror itself, Clive asked, produced by your looting ability, Jason.
That's right, Jason said. You keep waving that sausage around and it's going to end up on the other side of the room.
What?
Clive said, then looked at his fork as if surprised to find it there. He bit off the piece of sausage.
What I find interesting, Farrah said, is that a summon familiar was created through completely different means than the sanguine horror we killed. Yet, that's what Jason summoned.
A good thing they're different, Rufus said. We wouldn't want a sanguine horror roaming around at full strength.
Well, Clive said, is it possible that if Jason ever reached diamond rank, his familiar would attain the full strength of a sanguine horror? Of course, it would still be under his control, thus would be unlikely to scour all life from the planet.
I actually think I figured out what they wanted the horror for, Farrah said.
And you're only telling us now? Rufus asked.
Well, I've been going over that book from the Sacrifice Chamber, Farrah said. As it turns out, you can get a non-summoned sanguine horror as a familiar. First, you have to make the thing, which they did, or we did, whatever. But you start by making the thing, and then you have to starve it. It starts at bronze rank. That's how it was when we fought it. But it goes down to iron rank if you leave it long enough.
Can you do that with other monsters? Jason asked.
No, Farrah said. The sanguine horror comes with the inherent ability to shift ranks, which normally means going up, but down is possible too.
There are other monsters like that, Clive said. They're all quite rare, though.
Very, Farrah agreed.
So, once you have your sanguine horror, and you've starved it down to iron rank, you get the right essence and awakening stone, and then hope you get a familiar bond essence ability. There are no guarantees, of course.
Which essence and awakening stone are best? Clive asked.
For top reliability, Farrah said, according to the book, a blood essence and an apocalypse stone are what you're looking for.
That's exactly what I used, Jason said.
Why bother with all the big chamber and the sacrifices when you can just get one? Are the made ones better than the summoned ones? Do I have a defective familiar?
The actual sanguine horrors would be the same in terms of abilities, Farrah said. The difference would be the same as between any bonded familiar versus a summoned familiar.
Which are? Jason asked.
Bonded familiars survive, even if the essence user dies, Clive said.
A summoned familiar won't survive the death of the summoner, Farrah agreed. It also can disappear into the summoner's body, which bonded familiars can't.
That's all right, then, Jason said. I'd hate having to carry Colin around in a bag or something.
I still can't believe you named an apocalypse beast Colin, Rufus said.
Well, if you call your apocalypse beast Gorgos the enslaver of worlds, then people are likely to start questioning your intentions, Jason said.
That's actually a good point, Farrah said.
I have to imagine reliability is the key factor that led them to make the sanguine horror themselves, Clive said. When going for a bonded familiar instead of a summoned one, things are much more likely to go your way if you prepare accordingly. So long as you have the creature on hand and use the right essence and stone combination, that is as close as you'll come to a guaranteed result with any awakening stone. Look at your friend Humphrey and his dragon. I guarantee the Gellers didn't leave anything to chance.
Jason scowled.
They had a little bit of a tiff, Farrah said.
It wasn't a tiff, Jason said. It was a philosophical disagreement.
Of course it was, sweetie.
Actually, there's something I've been wondering about, Jason said. The sanguine horror we fought was vulnerable to salt.
I checked, and my familiar is the same. So how would it kill all life in the ocean, which is full of salt?
Those vulnerabilities would eventually go away, Farrah said. That book has a lot of details about sanguine horrors. It starts off a bronze rank, which is where we fought it, and has some extreme vulnerabilities at that stage. Fire and salt are the big ones, along with esoteric ones that only essence abilities can produce. But those vulnerabilities go away as it grows stronger. Salt stops being an issue once it reaches gold rank, after which it can go swimming all it likes.
I'd love to get a look at that book, Clive said.
Why didn't Anissa take it? Rufus asked. She was collecting everything.
From the manor, Farrah corrected. We weren't in the manor when we found it, so she had no right to it.
I'm not sure she would agree,
Gary said. His first contribution to the discussion, coincidentally, came right after his huge plate was emptied.
He's right, Rufus said. There's no way she would have quietly let you take it.
That's why I didn't tell her, Farrah said.
Good call, Jason said.
I still think there was something shady going on with that woman.
Didn't you say she was a priestess of purity?
Clive asked.
Exactly, Jason said. It's been a while since we've all been here together, Rufus said, as they stood in the yard behind Jory's clinic. There was less space than in the past, with construction materials taking up much of the room. Jory had purchased the large building next to the clinic, and renovations were in full swing. Like Jason, Rufus, Gary, and Farrah had all been carrying out contracts. Some they did together, others alone as they each pursued other projects. Rufus had preparations for his academy's joint venture with the Gellers, while Farrah had been undertaking work for the Magic Society. Gary had been exploring the use of local materials in crafting weapons and armor. He sold the work he was satisfied with at the trade hall, with no small success. The rune tortoise shield he made with Farrah had auctioned well, getting him a lot of attention. They started with weights training, which left Jason feeling inadequate. Rufus was bad enough, with the strength of a late-stage bronze ranker, but Farrah and Gary were worse. Farrah had a strength power from her earth essence, and Gary's race were all physically powerful. They were lifting half-ton barbells in each hand, while at least Rufus had the decency to struggle with one. By comparison, Jason was an out-of-shape guy in his first week at the gym. The others stopped to cool down as Jason headed inside, using his power to help the waiting patients. With clinic hours reduced by the expansion, and Jason often away on contracts, the clinic was more busy than ever.
"Haven't seen those friends of yours in a while," Jason said to Jory. "The fighter didn't get hurt too badly, did she?"
They had just healed up a pit fighter who had been cursed by an opponent.
"No, she's out of the pit fighting game again," Jory said. "Haven't seen them in a while."
Back outside, Rufus was waiting for Jason.
"Time to see if those skills have atrophied," Rufus said.
"Actually," Jason said, "I've been working on something. My martial art, the Way of the Reaper."
"What's wrong?" Rufus asked.
"Just saying it out loud makes me realize how over the top that name is. Where did you say that skill book came from?"
"I didn't say," Rufus said.
"Not like it matters," Jason said.
"I'm a kung fu wizard of darkness and blood. The good ship Chunibyo has well and truly set sail."
"Were you approaching some kind of point?" Rufus asked. "Or were you just going to stand there and spout nonsense?"
"He's done it before,"
Gary said, prompting a hurt look from Jason.
"He's done it a lot," Farrah added.
"Farrah, you too?" Jason asked.
"You were saying something about your martial art," Rufus asked impatiently.
"Right, yes," Jason said. "So my martial art has five forms, different approaches, different situations. At first, I thought it was about choosing the right form for the right enemy. Then I spent a lot of time fighting people in the Mirage Arena."
"I heard about that," Rufus said.
"Danielle said she had a recording to show me. I heard you were challenging all comers for most of a week. What did you learn in that time?"
"That the Gellers really teach their kids how to fight," Jason said. "I lost a lot of times."
"What else?" Rufus asked. "Only using a fifth of your martial arts is like only using a fifth of your martial arts. The forms aren't just five mini martial arts bundled into a skill book anthology. It was only when I started mixing things up that I realized the key to the whole thing."
"Which is?" Rufus asked.
"The real trick to the style is understanding how and when to move between forms. A well-timed, well-executed change in approach can clinch a victory."
Rufus took up a fighting stance.
"Show me."
Rufus was faster and stronger, with more skill and experience. In all their time training, Jason had never landed more than a glancing blow. Not only did this latest sparring session follow the same pattern, but Jason was performing worse than he had since the early days. Farrah and Gary watched from the side, using piles of bricks as furniture.
"I'm not impressed," Rufus said, after knocking Jason into the dirt again. "You're full of openings, more than when you first used the book. I think your attempts to change things up are making you lose what the book gave you in the first place."
Jason picked himself up from the dirt, body aching from the punishing lesson. He brushed himself down and resumed a fighting stance.
"Prove it," he said.
Spectating from the side, Gary chortled.
"It's on now," he said.
Jason's clear eyes locked on Rufus, who shook his head.
"Some people need the truth beaten into them," he said.
He came at Jason, hard and fast. Jason floundered back, narrowly avoiding a clean hit while almost tripping over his own feet. Rufus held the momentum ruthlessly, pushing Jason into a corner, both figuratively and literally. Jason stumbled as a finishing blow came ramming at him. But then his body shifted. Rufus's blow hit nothing but air as Jason shunted into his body, pushing Rufus off balance. Jason's elbow crashed into the side of Rufus's head, ringing it like a bell. Rufus staggered, and Jason pressed. But suddenly Rufus was moving twice as fast, and a fist slammed into Jason's gut, doubling him over and lifting him right off his feet. An elbow crashed down on the back of Jason's head, but Rufus stopped it before he smashed open Jason's skull. Jason collapsed to the ground anyway.
"Good," Rufus said, stepping back.
"Doesn't..."
Jason barely got a hoarse word out before a coughing fit sent blood speckling into the dirt. He pulled a healing potion from his inventory and tipped it down his throat.
"I think you might have gone a bit hard there, Rufus,"
Gary said.
"He did well," Rufus said. "Made me use my full strength for a moment. It was good."
"Doesn't feel good,"
Jason croaked.
"On your feet," Rufus said, coldly.
"Come on, Rufus," Farrah said. "You hit him so hard he had to drink a potion."
"Which he did," Rufus said. "So now he can get up."
Rufus walked over to where Jason was still laying in the dirt.
"This is where he gets to choose," Rufus says.
"Is he going to be adequate, or is he going to be great? Stand up or lay down. What's it going to be, Jason?"
Jason pushed himself up and onto his feet.
"You know," he said, "Instructor Rufus is kind of a prick. Haven't you heard of positive reinforcement?"
"All those openings you were showing," Rufus said. "They're a trap."
"Well, some of them are traps," Jason said. "It took you a while to go after the right one."
"Only once you close all those real openings will you have made the style your own," Rufus said.
"No," Jason said. "Once I transform every opening into a trap, then I've made it my own."
Rufus grinned.
"I like the ambition. You have a lot of work to do."
Chapter 76 Preparations.
"Mr. Asano," Gilbert greeted. "Always such a pleasure."
"Morning, Bert. Your message said you found something for me?"
Yes, Gilbert said, looking reluctant. "Loath as I am to refer you to my brother, he does have something that meets your specifications quite neatly. Of course, I could offer you something adequate myself, but adequate isn't the Gilbert's resilient attire for the discerning gentleman way."
Gilbert held out an envelope for Jason.
"Thanks, Bert. Good looking out, mate."
Filbert's Fine Leather Emporium was located in one of the other arcades within the trade hall complex, requiring Jason to pass through the main hall. He passed by Jory's stall along the way, although Jory himself was still overseeing renovations. Instead, it was being run by Jory's assistant, Janice.
"Hello, Mr. Asano."
"Hello, Janice. I don't suppose you have any crystal wash back there?"
"Now, Mr. Asano, you know what Mr. Tillman said. We have to keep some for the other customers."
"Janice," Jason said, voice buttery smooth. "Can't you just free up just a few little bottles? It can be our little secret."
"Mr. Asano, Mr. Tillman only produces 4 crates a week. And after you were so generous with the construction funding, he lets you take 2 of them. We keep having to turn people away because we've run out. He'll be stepping up production once his new workshop is up and running."
Jason shook his head sadly.
You're killing me, Janice. If I don't get that crystal wash, I'm going to end up all dirty. You don't want to be responsible for turning me into a dirty man, do you, Janice?
Her eyes ran Jason up and down.
I could live with it,
she said.
Janice,
Jason said, voice filled with admonishment. I've never heard the like. I think I'd better go. He moved on, Janice seeing him off with a coquettish wave.
What has gotten into that girl?
Moving through the main hall, he was stopped by some people he didn't know. It was a pair of young women with iron rank auras.
Excuse me,
one of them said.
Are you the guy with the evil powers?
Jason winced. Hannah Adir was the archer from Rick Geller's team, who Jason had fought in the Mirage Arena. She had apparently taken upon herself to distribute the recording of their fight, and Jason had been getting variations on the question for a week. Almost every time he visited the jobs hall or the trade hall, someone would approach him about it.
No, he said wearily. I don't have evil powers.
You're not the guy from the recording?
The other asked.
I am the person in the recording, but my powers aren't evil.
Controlling monsters seems pretty evil.
I don't control monsters.
Shaking his head, Jason walked away as the pair talked behind him.
I heard those leeches live inside his blood. I bet that's true. Kevin Wasserman has a lizard that lives inside his skin. That makes so much sense. His skin is always clammy.
Jason sighed, grateful as their voices were lost in the noise of the trade hall crowd. He found his way into the right arcade and entered Filbert's Fine Leather Emporium.
Hello, sir, and welcome to Filbert's Fine Leather Emporium, which is to say, we are an emporium of leather goods, not an emporium made of leather. Just a little joke we like to say around here. I'm the proprietor, Filbert, but you may call me Bert.
G'day, Bert.
Filbert, like the other Berts, was thick in the middle and thin on top. He wore a waistcoat and jacket, more snug than most local fashion and definitely too hot for the climate. Jason handed over the envelope. Filbert opened it up and read the contents with a frown.
I won't hold it against you, sir, that you chose to offer my brother your custom. Fortunately for you, Gilbert has acknowledged the superiority of my wares. You are looking for some specialized desert boots?
That's right, Jason said. I have a contract starting tomorrow involving desert travel. I want something that will work well in sand.
Well, if Gilbert sent you to me rather than selling you his usual tat, then you must be a gentleman of capability and means. He has suggested something he knows one of my fine craftspeople developed.
Filbert sent off a staff member hovering quietly to fetch something from the storage room in the back.
While Sweet Julio fetches the boots, Filbert said, is there anything else I can interest you in?
The store was laid out with lots of open space, the products displayed on wall racks. It was mostly shoes and accessories, like bags and belts. Jason's eye was drawn to a row of bags that looked like simple leather sacks. He reached out and touched one.
Item: dimensional bag, iron rank, rare. A bag that contains a dimensional storage space. Container: bag. Effect: can be used to store items in an extra-dimensional void. Effect: can fill a bag slot, increasing inventory space by 8.
Bag slot.
Help: bag slots. Bag slots can use dimensional bags to expand inventory size. Increase is based on rank of bag. At iron rank, one bag slot is available and can hold only iron rank bags.
Jason opened his inventory, seeing 5 new squares in the corner. The first square was glowing, while the others were greyed out.
Dimensional bags, Filbert said. Crafted right here in the workshop from Mirage Hound Leather. A common enough monster in the desert, but quite tricky to catch. Not so much once they've been around long enough to turn aggressive, but the leather has degraded by then, becoming sadly useless.
You hire adventurers to hunt them for you?
Jason asked.
Yes, Filbert said. But it's tricky work, and they appear out in the dunes. Hiring someone with the skills to both hunt them and harvest the pelt requires incentive. Thus, I can only offer them at a premium price.
I'll take one, Jason said.
Capability and means, Filbert said.
My fine customers are usually possessed of one or the other, but just between you and I, sir, all my favourite customers have both.
I imagine they do, Jason said, wryly. The store assistant, Julio, brought out a large, single, oversized leather boot. Filbert took the large boot from Julio and from inside pulled a box made of stiff, woven reeds, dyed black.
Novelty shape dimensional bag, Filbert said, resting a hand on the boot-shaped magical bag. He opened the box and took out a pair of boots that were a different thing altogether. Matte black with sleek lines, sides embedded with a mesh of black shards.
I rather like these particular boots, Filbert said. If you're looking to spend time in the dunes, you won't find anything close to this quality anywhere close to this price point. I should warn you, however, that it has been the more skilled clientele who have enjoyed the most success with this design. The ordinary adventurer would be better served by a more basic product.
That's some fine salesmanship, Bert, Jason said, as he looked the boots over. Who wants to think of themselves as an ordinary adventurer? It's a profession for those looking to be extraordinary.
Sir, I can assure you, I stand behind my products.
Oh, I don't doubt it, Jason said. I found your brothers to be upright in all their dealings. I was actually complimenting you. I appreciate someone who wields their words with purpose and care.
I'm glad to hear it, sir. Although, as upright dealings go, it seems you haven't met my brother Hubert.
Haven't had the pleasure, no, Jason said, taking the boots from Filbert's hands.
Item, sandcutter boots, iron rank, rare. Boots incorporating the chitin of sandcutter, inheriting some of its power, apparel, boots. Effect, improved ability to walk on sand. Effect, increased jump height and distance. Effect, enhanced kick attack, highly effective against enemies with strong earth affinity.
What's a sand cutter? Jason asked.
Ah, you have a good eye, sir. Are you familiar with the grasshopper and the mantis?
I am.
Well, the sand cutter is about halfway between, except it's 4 feet long and lives in the desert.
That sounds horrifying.
They're actually quite good at hunting mirage hounds, Filbert said. Shame you can't train them.
Filbert rubbed a hand over his mouth, thoughtfully.
You know, he said, I did just hear about an adventurer that can control monsters. I wonder if I could get into contact with him.
That's an unfounded rumour, Jason said, darkly.
Filbert, sensitive to the mood of the customer, returned the boots to the box.
I imagine you'd know, sir, being a capable adventurer. So it was just the boots and the dimensional bag?
Thank you, Bert.
The first green pill will change your aura, Belinda said. Don't use any mana, or they'll be able to sense your real aura through the fake one. I don't have to tell you how fast they'll be on someone with two auras. Once you've got the goods, get to the change point where I'll be waiting.
I know all this, Sophie said. We've been over it many times.
Would you rather be bored from hearing it too much or caught from hearing it too little?
Sophie let out a sigh.
Right, yes. No using mana.
At the change point, Belinda continued, I'll give you the blue pill, which will purge the aura of the first green pill. That will take a minute to completely go through your system, during which time you change outfits. Then I give you the second green pill for another false aura. You leave the goods behind and catch the loop line to Marina South.
I don't like leaving you behind.
I have to clear the goods of anything they've done to track them. The change point and the contingency point are the only places I have shielded from whatever they might be using.
No one knows what we're after, Sophie said.
How would they know what to tag? Ventress has been pushing people hard, Belinda said. We don't know if she's compromised any of the people I sourced our assets from. If she's figured out the target, or even narrowed it down, she may have warned the potential targets. Even if she hasn't, you know the kind of people we've been stealing from. They probably tagged their valuables themselves.
Sophie shook her head.
I hate this, she said. I'm amazed we haven't been caught already.
Thank the Adventure Society, Belinda said. Because you aren't even Iron Rank, they're refusing to let anyone higher than Iron go after you. So the only bronze rankers you'll have to deal with are any that decide to chase you in the moment. That's why you don't want to get caught swapping your aura mask. And if a silver comes after me? I can't imagine a silver who would deign to bother with you. They don't want to be seen doing iron rank work. But that's why the disguise isn't magical. It'll hold up under magical scrutiny. So will the fake aura, as long as you don't use any mana. Are you sure about those pills? Sophie asked. The guy sells low-quality potions to poor people in Old City. Every other alchemist I've heard of rakes in money from rich people on the island. He knows what he's doing, Belinda said, and just as importantly, doesn't know what we're doing. He doesn't ask questions because he's sweet on me. How sweet will he be when Ventress sends Darnell to break his elbows? She can't, Belinda said. He's in the Alchemy Association and the Adventure Society. And you? What about me? Are you sweet on him, Lindy? Is your judgment compromised? My judgment has gotten us this far, Belinda said, and I'm hardly the one with a questionable taste in men. Could you pick one guy who wasn't a con man or some kind of swindler? They're more fun. Three of your lovers tried to sell you to Cole Silver. That would inspire most people to examine their taste in men, but you pick up every lying, scheming weasel that stumbles into view. Not everyone, Sophie said. And they weren't lovers. They were just a bit of fun. And things didn't exactly work out for them, did they? The point is, you need to raise your standards. We aren't in a great place to be socializing right now, but if you're going to pick a guy, pick a good one. Then find me a good guy who's also a lying, scheming weasel. Belinda groaned. I don't think there is anyone like that, Belinda said. He'd have to be a crazy person. She pulled out a pocket watch to check the time, then put on her game face. 4 minutes, she said. Time to go.
Chapter 77 Group Cohesion. Jason walked through the Adventure Society campus with a recording crystal floating over his head.
Looks a lot like a university campus, he continued narrating. It's more about child soldiers than education, though. Not super young, more America than Sierra Leone. Late mid-teens.
The marshalling yard came into sight, where a number of young adventurers were loosely gathered.
As you can see, late teens. The big one, with the bird on his shoulder, is my friend Humphrey, who I've mentioned before. We had a bit of a fight last week, and we haven't talked much since, so things are still a little tense.
Jason saw Humphrey's face light up with a smile, and followed his gaze to where an extremely pretty young woman was approaching him with a wave.
That girl walking up to him is Gabrielle. She's a priestess in training, with the god of knowledge. Goddess, whatever. Deities are gender-fluid, as it turns out. Heard that from the goddess of knowledge herself. Direct quote. Oh, yeah, I found religion, which is kind of a big deal. I didn't join, but I found it. It seems fine. Not for me, but who knows? Maybe there's a god of delicious sandwiches. If God helps those who help themselves, then the god of sandwiches might offer a two-for-one deal. I might check that out.
Jason took a pocket watch from his inventory, checked the time, and then turned away from the marshalling yard.
Still got time to check if that bloke with the juice stall is on campus today. An interesting fact about the goddess of knowledge is that she knows everything that anyone in this world knows, including me, which means she knows a bunch of Mario Kart shortcuts, which is kind of awesome.
Jason spotted a cart stall set up on the main promenade. The proprietor had set up an awning for shade, with a folding table, under which were boxes of fruit and large paper cups.
There he is. Nice.
Jason joined the short queue, soon reaching the front.
Blasphemer? The man running the stall casually greeted him. Gods haven't struck you down yet?
He was a runic, with the usual dark skin marked by faintly glowing runes.
Not yet. Sorry, Arash.
They had first met right before Jason saw his first god. Arash hadn't been happy with Jason's lack of reverence, but that wasn't enough to make him turn away a customer.
What do you have for me today? Jason asked.
I just got in the first gem berries of the season, Arash said.
I can do you a blend with Bloodwing cherries over ice. I think you'll like.
Sounds refreshing, Jason said. I'm heading into the desert, so rack me up a half dozen.
Perhaps the goddess of Earth will drown you in sand, Arash said optimistically.
I guess all you can do is pray. Arash tapped his finger on a plate fixed into the table in front of him, which lit up with a glowing magic circle. He started tossing fruit into the air, which stopped over the magic circle as if caught by an invisible hand. From crates under the table, he threw out berries, cherries, and a few other fruits, as well as ice from a magical freezer box. Each fruit he threw up floated in a slow circuit over the magic circle. Arash placed 6 large paper cups on the table, in the circle under the floating fruit. He took out a pair of crystal rods the size of knitting needles and started waving them about with practiced ease. They didn't touch the fruit, which nonetheless reacted to their waving like an orchestra to a conductor. Fruit peeled itself, pureeing in the air as berries, cherries, and ice were crushed. None of the resulting slurry splashed away or onto the table. At the direction of Arish's needles, it separated into 6 portions and slid into the cups. Putting down the 2 rods, Arash added a paper straw to each cup. Jason paid in lesser spirit coins, then took an experimental sip, giving it a solid thumbs up.
Oh, that's a winner, Jason said. He placed the other cups in his inventory, keeping one to drink immediately.
What's with the recording crystal?
Arash asked, looking at the object floating over Jason's head.
I'm making a record of what my life is like here, Jason said. Something to show the family if I ever get home. Now they get to see you making a delicious beverage.
I don't think that it'll be that exciting, Arash said.
You might be surprised.
Where is home?
Further away than even the gods can reach.
Get away from my stall, blasphemer.
Jason chuckled.
Will you be here all day?
He asked. I could see myself picking up another round when I get back from the desert.
I'll be at the Magic Society in the afternoon. You just be careful out there.
No worries, mate.
Jason stowed the crystal away as he wandered back in the direction of the marshalling yard. There were benches around the side, and he sat alone, looking over the assembled adventurers. After months of observation training with Farah, Jason quickly took everything in. Who was alone, who was in a group, what their body language said about group dynamics, what equipment did they have? It was hard to tell who was under-equipped for a journey into the desert and who had a storage space like Jason. Farah had drilled Jason to quickly and thoroughly recognize and catalogue such details. They would watch people in places around the city, outside Jory's clinic, the Adventure Society campus, the concert hall. In addition to the practical use of observation skills, exercising the mind also exercised the spirit attribute. It was just as important as working on the power attribute by weightlifting. Humphrey glanced over at Jason with a complicated expression before turning back to his conversation with Gabrielle and another young woman. Jason gave him an awkward smile back.
Don't tell me the honeymoon is over.
A sneering voice came in Jason's direction. Jason had spotted Thadwick Mercer and his offsiders, not paying him any attention until Thadwick loudly approached Jason.
Not on the outs with Geller, are you? Thadwick asked. I thought you were friends.
It hurt his feelings that I've been spending so much time with your sister. Do say hello to Cassandra for me.
Thadwick turned red with fury, pointing a finger in Jason's face. Stay away from my sister, you jumped-up commoner trash!
Jason glanced at the 2 flanking Thadwick, who looked more embarrassed than supportive. From what Humphrey had told him, they were both stuck under Thadwick due to their families. Thadwick Mercer's family was very powerful in Greenstone. This was only highlighted when the Duke of Greenstone's brother, Thadwick's father, married into it. The power of the Mercer family placed it above numerous others, especially those without aristocratic title. According to Humphrey, both of Thadwick's lackeys were positioned there to help their family interests, rather than any actual regard or friendship. Rufus considered this a shame, as he had evaluated them both highly during their field assessment. They had both passed where Thadwick and Humphrey failed. Jason was about to say something else when he spotted Vincent Trenslow coming out of the nearby administration building.
Paying no more attention to Thadwick, Jason got up and joined the others in converging on the Adventure Society official. The group was 10 altogether, including Jason himself. He knew Humphrey, Gabrielle, and sadly, Thadwick. He'd recognized Thadwick's offsiders, although he hadn't spoken with them at all. The others he didn't know, including the woman Humphrey and Gabrielle had been talking to. She looked a little older than the others, maybe 18 or 19.
"Everyone, listen up," Vincent told them. "Your task today is to head out to Spirit Coin Farm, Gela 7. There you will meet with a bronze rank adventurer and assist him in escorting a shipment of spirit coins back to the city."
"Who's in charge?" Thadwick called out.
"The bronze ranker who you're going to meet," Vincent said irritably.
"If they'll only be with us for the journey back," Thadwick said. "What about on the way there? I think I'm the clear choice for leader. My team is the largest group here."
"That's only 3 people out of 10, you nonce," a woman said. Jason didn't know her at all, but she immediately made a favourable impression.
"It's still the largest," Thadwick said. "And, of course, you all know who my family is."
Some of the people looked awkward, others disdainful. Jason chuckled quietly to himself, wondering if Thadwick should be the basis of a drinking game. One of Thadwick's offsiders put a hand over his own face while the other winced, looking at his feet.
"Contrary to what you may think," Vincent said, "young Master Mercer is quite right."
That drew everyone's attention back to Vincent.
"There may be minimal risk on the outward leg of your trip, but there is always a chance something goes wrong. If you encounter a bronze rank monster, then you will need to make a coordinated response. A leader can direct you to fight as a team, instead of as individuals."
"Which means doing what I say,"
Thadwick said, with smug satisfaction. Jason snorted a laugh at Thadwick, setting the self-destruct on his own dignity.
"Actually," Vincent said, "that means doing what young Mistress Geller says."
He put a hand on the shoulder of the woman Humphrey had been talking to that Jason didn't recognize.
"For those who haven't met her, this is Phoebe Geller. She will be the group leader until you reach the Spirit Coin Farm."
"Why her?" Thadwick asked.
"Because she has done this before," Vincent said. "Because she actually knows the way to the Spirit Coin Farm, and finally, because she's the only 2-star adventurer here, which puts her 1.5 stars over you, Thadwick."
Confusion crossed Thadwick's face.
1.5 stars? Thadwick said. "You can't get 0.5 stars.
Jason burst out laughing, drawing Thadwick's ire.
"You find something funny?" Thadwick asked him.
Jason looked at Thadwick's face and cracked up all the harder.
"He's saying," Jason chuckled, "that you're 0.5 star because you're not a legitimate adventurer."
Thadwick's face was a mix of anger and pride, fueled by a nagging sense of inadequacy.
"Do you know who my uncle is?" Thadwick asked.
"And drink," Jason said, sipping at his fruit beverage.
"What?"
Thadwick asked. "Of course I know who your uncle is," Jason said. "Everyone knows who your uncle is. That's the whole point. Thadwick Mercer never passed the Adventure Society assessment.
The Duke of Greenstone's nephew did."
"I hate to break it to you, Thadwick Mercer, but the only part of your name anyone respects is the last part. You can't be the leader because no one trusts you to do anything. At all. The guys on your team, they have to carry you so hard that it's training. They're really good because they're compensating for your outlandish lack of competence." He gestured at the gathered adventurers. "This job means placing our lives in one another's hands. No one here is going to trust you with their life. They might not tell you that, Thadwick, because you're so petty, entitled, and insecure that you'll hurt them or their families using your own family's egregious level of influence. Which is, to be clear, the only reason anyone, anywhere, puts up with you for so much as a single moment." As Jason's rant came to a close, most of the people looked on in shocked silence. Humphrey, having seen Jason's mouth run away from him before, was shaking his head.
"You aren't doing a lot for group cohesion, Jason," Humphrey said.
Jason looked over at Humphrey and absently nodded.
Yeah, that one got away from me. I don't have to put up with this, Thadwick snapped. I'm leaving, and you will pay for this insult, Asano.
Thadwick started storming off, then realized his lackeys hadn't followed.
Well?
He asked them, turning back.
We were assigned to this contract, one of them said. We're refusing it, Thadwick said.
The society doesn't like it when you refuse an assigned contract, the other lackey responded.
Who cares? My uncle will put them in line.
And drink, Jason said, finishing off his juice. Thadwick marched off again. The pair of reluctant flunkies looked at each other unhappily, then followed.
Maybe it was good for group cohesion after all, someone said. Thadwick's gone.
It wasn't, Phoebe Geller said. Our only healer just walked off after him. A slew of unhappy gazes were turned on Jason, who winced.
Sorry, he said.
Chapter 78. Jason has the good biscuits. The group, now reduced to 7, made their way through the desert sand. This was proper desert, with blistering sun scouring any life out of the rolling dunes. There were no landmarks, so Jason checked his map from time to time. It unveiled nothing but empty desert as they passed through it, but he saw they were traveling in a dead straight line. Leading from the front, Phoebe Geller knew exactly where she was going. Jason had prepared thoroughly for the trip, even though it was expected to only last a day. Aside from the juice he picked up, he had ample supplies of food and water. He could get what he needed from spirit coins, but he had once found himself in the desert, benefiting from Farah having packed bottles of water. His oasis bracelet protected him from the heat, and he had plenty of spare water quintessence to fuel it. He also had his new boots, which were already paying off. While others were trudging through the sand, the magic of his boots made every step light and easy. He'd also brought along some combat items, as open desert was not an environment that played to his strengths. His belt had loops containing vials with various utility potions, along with the usual health and mana potions. The magic on the belt was designed to protect the vials from incidental damage. The belt also carried the sword Gary had made, in a scabbard on Jason's left hip. His snake-tooth dagger was sheathed on the right. He wore a bandolier diagonally across his chest, with 9 throwing darts sheathed into it. Each dart had a small, corded grip, in different colors. 3 had a black cord, 3 had dark orange, with the last 3 being green. It quickly became clear which members of the group had joined Jason in making appropriate preparations. Humphrey, Phoebe, and Gabrielle were easily chatting as if strolling through a garden. The other 3 struggled with the sand underfoot and the sun overhead. They repeatedly used spirit coins to replenish their reserves.
This contract will cost us more coins than it gets us, one of them complained.
Then you should have prepared, Phoebe said. Look at how comfortable Jason is. All eyes turned to Jason, sipping on an icy fruit drink. One of the exhausted adventurers narrowed her eyes at Jason.
Aren't you that guy with the evil powers?
Jason shot a withering look at Phoebe, who gave him a wink and a cheeky smile in return. Jason returned the drink to his inventory. One of his favorite things about the inventory power was that anything he took out was in the same state he put in. Food stayed fresh, drinks stayed cold. His food supply included bread straight from the oven that would stay warm and fresh until he took it out again. One of the adventurers Jason didn't know suddenly called out.
Everyone, stop!
What is it? Phoebe asked.
There's something under the sand ahead of us, the adventurer called out.
There were many kinds of perception powers. Some saw through darkness, like Jason's ability, while others had superior aura perception, or could see magic. Common to the Earth essence was a tremor sense power, able to detect things in or on the ground over large distances.
Jason, Phoebe said,
You cost us our healer, so you're the bait.
Jason nodded, walking ahead of the others as the starlight cloak formed around him. He kept a quick but measured pace, ready to react at any time.
How close? He called back. About a dozen meters in front of you.
Jason stopped, drawing one of the green corded darts from his bandolier. It was a single-use magic item that would manifest a false aura on impact. He threw it into the ground, a dozen meters ahead of him, where it struck the sand. Sand exploded into the air as a monster erupted from the ground. It looked like a giant emaciated shark, but with shell instead of skin, spidery crustacean legs, and huge pincers.
A shab?
It looked similar to the shabs Jason had encountered in the past, but at least triple the size. Instead of the red and purple coloration, it was sandy yellow. The creature skittered about, as if confused, then seemed to spot Jason and move towards him. Jason walked towards the creature, in turn, as he drew another dart. This one had a black cord, and he tossed it at the creature. The dart bounced off its shell, the impact triggering the dart. Darkness burst out of the dart, shadows engulfing the creature in defiance of the glaring sun. It wasn't complete darkness, instead a murky region of roiling shadow. Jason continued forwards, casually walking into the dark mass as if he hadn't noticed it. The other adventurers looked on as Jason vanished into the shadows.
What is that thing? Humphrey asked.
A sand shab, Phoebe said. Bigger than the aquatic variety. Likes to drag victims under the sand instead of underwater.
Should we help? Gabrielle asked.
Alien shrieks of monstrous rage came from within the darkness.
I wouldn't bother, Jason said, suddenly next to them.
Phoebe looked between Jason and the darkness into which he had vanished.
Teleport? She asked.
Shadow teleport, Jason said.
What shadow?
Jason looked down, and she followed his gaze to see he was standing in her own shadow.
That's sneaky.
The monster isn't dead, Gabrielle pointed out. Angry cries were still emerging from the patch of shadow, which was fading away. They could see the outline of the monster within.
The darkness fades over time, Jason said. It'll last about 30 seconds total.
He casually restocked his bandolier darts from his inventory. In his other hand was his dagger, blade slick with yellow ichor. He took out a rag and started wiping it clean.
What about the monster? Gabrielle asked.
It'll last about 50 seconds total, Jason said. That's a guess, since I'm going to try a new ability.
The last vestiges of the magic shadow faded, the shab scrambling around in confusion. It spotted the adventurers and headed in their direction.
Jason?
Humphrey said.
Yes, Humphrey?
It's coming this way.
Shabs aren't very quick, Jason said. I just need those afflictions to stack up a little more.
He finished cleaning his dagger, returning it to its sheath. He glanced over at the approaching shab. It wasn't built for forwards movement, skittering side to side as it came. He raised an arm in its direction, chanting out a spell.
Suffer the cost of your transgressions!
Black spread out across the shell of the monster, as if it were passing into shadow. Its hectic skittering slowed to an uneasy stagger. When one of its shell-encrusted legs crumbled like dry, stale bread, it collapsed to the ground. More of its shell broke apart to reveal blackened, withered flesh. It didn't get back up.
Ability, punition, doom, spell, cost, moderate mana, cooldown, 30 seconds, current rank, iron, 0.01%, effect, iron, inflicts necrotic damage for each curse, disease, poison, and unholy affliction the target is suffering.
Jason?
Humphrey asked.
Yes, Humphrey?
What just happened to that monster?
Massive necrosis.
I'm not sure what that means.
Well, Jason said, you know what happens to a body when it dies? A regular body, I mean, not a monster body.
I'm roughly familiar, Humphrey said.
I convinced its body to do that, Jason said.
Just very quickly and while it was still alive.
Jason?
Yes, Humphrey.
Are you that guy with the evil powers?
I hope you get eaten by a Shab. The seven adventurers continued their trek through the desert. The three Jason didn't know were bringing up the rear, sweat pouring out of them, as they were still forced to replenish themselves with spirit coins. Phoebe and Gabrielle were together, glancing over at Jason and Humphrey, talking loudly.
How did so many people even see it? Jason complained. It was just that archer distributing copies, right?
Actually, my mother started to help, Humphrey said. Our people have a lot of family pride, which is good, but she doesn't want us veering into, let's call it, Thadwick territory. So she started showing people a recording of some random guy no one has heard of going 1v5 with a bunch of your family members?
That's the basic idea, yes.
She could have asked, Jason said.
I thought the whole point was to intimidate people.
Yeah, well, that was my toony tendencies getting away from me. Now everyone thinks I control monsters. How would I not be the strongest iron ranker in Greenstone if I could control hundreds of trap weavers?
What are toony tendencies?
My powers aren't evil, Jason said. You breathe fire. Burning to death isn't exactly a fun way to go.
You do have a leech colony living inside you.
Lots of people have summoned familiars.
Humphrey's familiar, Stash, was happily walking along next to Humphrey's feet. He barked happily, like a dog, which was a little odd given that he was currently a lizard.
Who's a good boy? Jason said,
prompting Stash to transform into a small bird and flutter up onto Jason's shoulder. Jason took a biscuit from his inventory and held it up for the bird, who turned into a puppy and snuffled it out of Jason's hand. Jason used the empty hand to stop the enthusiastic puppy from falling down.
You spoil him, Humphrey said.
He deserves it.
Stash yapped his agreement, spilling crumbs. From where she was walking beside Phoebe, Gabrielle looked on unhappily.
Why does he like Jason more than me? She asked.
Which one? Phoebe asked. Humphrey or Stash? That earned her a sharp elbow. As Gabrielle had the mite essence, it sent Phoebe reeling.
Sorry, Gabrielle said with a wince.
Phoebe regained her balance, shaking her head.
Maybe you should carry biscuits around,
Phoebe suggested, nodding at Jason, feeding the puppy another one.
Biscuits for who? Gabrielle asked. Humphrey or Stash?
Phoebe laughed.
I actually did try that, Gabrielle confessed. I think Jason has better biscuits than me. He makes them himself.
I didn't think you knew Jason that well, Phoebe said.
The goddess told me.
The goddess told you he makes his own biscuits?
She seems strangely interested in him.
Oh?
I saw them together, briefly. It was a weird atmosphere.
You don't suppose she's, you know, interested?
Dear gods, no. Gabrielle laughed. I think it's because he's an outworlder. He doesn't act the way other people do. She said he's dangerous.
How can that guy be dangerous to a goddess?
Not to her, Gabrielle said. To me. She thinks he's a threat to impressionable young minds.
She'd know, I guess, Phoebe said. Suddenly the adventurer with the tremor sense called out in alarm.
Everyone, stop!
What is it? Phoebe asked.
There's something around us. All around us.
Everyone went on alert, scanning the empty desert terrain.
Is it in the sand?
Humphrey asked.
I think it is the sand.
Chapter 79. Sand Everywhere. Chaos erupted as the sand came to life all around them, surging like waves. From the empty desert, they were suddenly surrounded, the sand rising up to take a variety of crude forms. None were any larger than a person, but there were dozens of them, from misshapen torsos like half-melted snowmen, to sharks swimming through the sand like it was water.
The shapes were all poorly formed, without delicate features. New quest. Elemental ambush. You have been surrounded by sand elementals. Defeat them before your team is overwhelmed. Objective. Defeat lesser sand elemental attack. Reward. Quintessence.
Sand elementals! Jason heard Phoebe shout over the sudden chaos. Use powerful attacks to completely break up their forms, or they'll just recover.
Jason released his aura as he felt others wash over him. You are in the area of an ally's dragon might aura. Your power and spirit attributes are increased. You are in the area of an ally's presence of the master aura. The effect of your essence abilities is increased. He could easily sense Humphrey and Phoebe through their auras. Gabrielle and one of the other adventurers also projected auras, but they didn't seem to affect him. Unfortunately, Jason's own aura was unlikely to have a large impact on the fight. Ability, hegemony, sin, aura, holy, unholy, cost, none, cooldown, none, current rank, iron, 3, 14%. Effect, iron. Allies within the aura have increased resistance to afflictions, while enemies within the aura have their resistance to afflictions reduced. Enemy resistances are further reduced for each instance of sin they are afflicted with. He doubted creatures made of sand would be using any afflictions, and his own would certainly not affect them. For that reason, he drew the sword Gary had made for him instead of his dagger. By the time it cleared the scabbard, Humphrey was already in motion beside him. Dragon-scale armor shimmered into existence around Humphrey as an enormous wing-shaped sword appeared in his hand. He swept it in a wide arc at the three elementals closest to himself and Jason. They exploded as the sword hit them, showering Humphrey and Jason in sand as the sword didn't even slow down.
"You good?"
Humphrey asked Jason. Jason's starlight cloak manifested around him.
"Do your thing, mate."
Humphrey nodded as dragon wings appeared on his back. They launched him into the air, beating to hold him aloft as he surveilled the team. Phoebe was fine, blasting huge chunks off elementals with explosive palm strikes. Gabrielle had conjured a huge iron staff that was twirling around her like she was putting on a show. Any elemental foolish enough to get close was torn apart by its powerful momentum. Two of the other adventurers were holding their own back-to-back against the elementals, while the last one was alone and already struggling. Humphrey didn't know him before they teamed up, but seeing he was an elf, the man was almost certainly a spellcaster. Close combat was likely to be the man's least favorable circumstance, so Humphrey dived in immediately. Humphrey's wings pushed up hard, sending him plunging into a dive bomb special attack. Hurtling out of the sky, his feet smashed apart an elemental as he passed through it to land, the wings on his back vanishing as his sword lashed out. The might essence was one of the most common essences to be found, yet also one of the most highly regarded. Even someone as privileged as Humphrey, who had his pick of essences, had chosen to use it. It was a simple essence, with simple abilities. Mighty strength, for example, was exactly what the name suggested. As the most common ability of the most popular common essence, it was the single most common essence ability in the entire world. No one needed to have explained what made the might essence so popular, but anyone would think Humphrey was going out of his way to demonstrate. He swung his enormous sword with power and precision, as if it weighed almost nothing. Every elemental it touched blew up like a car in an 80s action movie, showering the area with sand. After clearing some space, Humphrey spared a glance for the beleaguered elf, who looked at him with gratitude.
"Keep them off me and I can take a bunch of them out,"
the elf told him.
"Do what you need to do," Humphrey said. "I've got you."
In the meantime, Jason was dealing with elementals of his own. He lashed out with his sword, to minimal effect. Special attack, punish, has inflicted sin on lesser sand elemental. Lesser sand elemental is immune to afflictions. Sin does not take effect. Affliction immunity has triggered an effect on weapon, dread salvation. Weapon, dread salvation, has gained an instance of stone cutter. Jason lashed out with quick, light strikes, putting a special attack into each one. The blade barely finished making a cut before sand removed any trace, but that was never the goal. Each failed affliction triggered the effect of his sword, which grew more powerful with every strike.
Stonecutter, magic, stacking. All attacks deal additional resonating force damage, highly effective against physical defenses. Additional instances have a cumulative effect.
Every attack started blasting sand off the elementals, but had yet to leave a lasting impact. The sword might not deter the encroaching elementals, but he had an answer for that. He would keep one elemental to build up stacks with his sword, a sluggish, snowman-shaped one, too slow to pose a real threat. At others, he would lash out with kicks, not hitting the creatures, but slicing his foot past them. As he did, a razor whip of black shards extended from his boot, cutting through the elemental and scattering it to the winds.
I love these boots.
Item, sandcutter boots, iron rank, rare.
Boots crafted with the chitin of a sandcutter, inheriting some of its power.
Apparel, boots. Effect, improved ability to walk on sand. Effect, increased jump height and resistance. Effect, enhanced kick attack, highly effective against enemies with strong earth affinity.
It was taking time to accumulate power onto Jason's sword, but with dozens of elementals still swarming them, he was in no danger of running out. With every attack, the sword's power grew. Sand started blasting off the elementals as it landed, leaving noticeable gouges. He became more aggressive, lashing out with his sword and his razor whip boots. The sword kept getting stronger until it was carving a path through the elementals. By the time he fought his way over to Humphrey, Jason's sword had joined his boots in taking down elementals at a single blow. Humphrey had set about keeping the elementals off the spellcaster. By the time Jason reached them, the elf behind Humphrey had gathered a huge sphere of white and fire-orange magic over his head. Looking up at it with a wild grin, he started chanting.
Fire and air, fuel and feast, come forth and devour the vortex beast.
Hey, that rhymes, Jason said, as they watched the orb drift slowly over their heads, drifting towards the largest mass of elementals. Heat and wind washed over them as it passed. Then they heard the elf behind them yell out.
Run!
They turned to see the elf already following his own advice, sprinting away from his own spell at top speed. Jason and Humphrey glanced at one another and did the same. A few seconds later, there was a cacophonous